to We the People Radio. My name is Erin Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
And I'm Debbie Bacigalupi, the sit-in guest.
Yeah,
host.
Welcome.
Got everybody in here today. Got a full studio. Who's our sponsor this hour, Bill?
Our sponsor this hour is Team Power. The guys over at Team Power can do pretty much anything you want on the farm. We can work on tractors, work on mowers, work on pretty much anything. They can also give you a great deal on new equipment. Give them a call over there at 226-9226. They're at 3119 Twinview Boulevard. Or you can reach them on the web at readingtractors.com.
Can they stop global warming, Team Power?
Oh, they're already working on that. Yeah, guys out in the shop, they can, man, they're tinkers. They can
tinkers.
Do it.
Tinkers. Classic. So you can find all the information about the show. We're not going to goof off so much today because we have a great guest for you. But you can find everything about the program and our guest and all the things we're speaking about at WeThePeopleRadio.us. So our guest today is Dr. Patrick Moore. You might have heard of him. He's been in the news just a tiny bit lately, a little more than usual. And we have this guest through our friend Debbie. So
yeah, and when Erin says a tiny bit, she is just kind of under exaggerating.
Yeah, tiny bit.
Yeah, he's been in the news a lot, and ever since the green new raw ugly deal has surfaced, it has been for many of us a gold mine, because finally, after all these years of trying to expose this radical agenda called sustainable development, Alexandria Ocommunist has made it so easy for us to talk about what these radical extreme plans are. So
in case you've been living under a rock, Dr. Patrick Moore, I just thought, you know, for maybe our friends who aren't paying attention, Dr. Patrick Moore has been a leader in the environment, in the international environmental field for over 30 years. And contrary to Google and Wikipedia, he is the founding member of Greenpeace, and served for 9 years as president of Greenpeace Canada and 7 years as director of Greenpeace International. He's the leader of many campaigns, and Dr. Moore was a driving force shaping policy and direction while Greenpeace became the world's largest environmental activist organization. On the web, you can find him at ecosense.me.
Ecosense.me. And correct me if I'm wrong, Dr. Moore, you are the only PhD, the only doctor.
The only actual scientist?
Yes. At Greenpeace as co-founder?
Well, of course, I left Greenpeace now. It dates me pretty badly, 33 years ago. But I was in the leadership for 15 years from the beginning of the organization until I left because I disagreed with the direction my fellow directors were taking it, none of whom had any formal science education. So I don't know of any scientist that is actually in the leadership of Greenpeace today. They are mostly political activists and mostly on the extreme left, which is kind of why I left, because the extreme left took over Greenpeace after 15 years of activism in which we did a lot of good things, saving the whales and stopping nuclear testing both underground and in the atmosphere, and eventually really focusing on toxic dumping into the air and water, and cleaned up a lot of places around the world. So I'm proud of what we did back then, unfortunately, like they say, some organizations, they start out with good intentions. Eventually they change into a kind of business because they got 300 people on the payroll, and then they become a racket, and that's what happened to Greenpeace.
So are you saying you've extracted yourself from the 98% of scientists that believe we're all going to die in 12 years?
Yeah. Well, that whole thing about the consensus is kind of laughable for two reasons. I mean, the first one is the hardcore one, and the fact is there are not 98 or 97 or whatever percent they say of scientists who believe that we are causing catastrophic climate change. And that's how they make it out. A large number of scientists do believe that humans are somehow involved in the changing climate in the last 150 years or so because we started using fossil fuels and put carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. But there's also a very large number of scientists who realize that that is not the main cause of climate change. The climate has been changing through the eons and millennia ever since the Earth was born, and that most of the causes of climate change are natural, and the more I study it, the more I realize that probably pretty well all the changes that have occurred in the climate over the millions and thousands of years are naturally induced by a number of factors, one of which is greenhouse gases, but actually water vapor is the main greenhouse gas, and it is far more abundant in the atmosphere than carbon dioxide and is at least 95% of the greenhouse effect, which means that carbon dioxide is an insignificant player in the whole thing, even if it is, you know, has a bit part.
So where does the water vapor come from?
The ocean. Let me just give you the numbers. Carbon dioxide concentration in the global atmosphere is 0.04%. In other words, 0.04%.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not, and 400 parts per million sounds like a lot, but it's 400 parts per million, which is 0.04%. Whereas water is in the lower atmosphere between 1% and 5%, which is 25 to 125 times as high a concentration as CO2. And in addition, water vapor has a higher band of absorption of infrared radiation, which is what a greenhouse gas does. And therefore, molecule for molecule, water is a more powerful greenhouse gas than CO2, which relegates CO2 to somewhere between 1 and 3% of the greenhouse effect, which could easily be swamped by any number of other factors, because it's only if all else were equal that CO2 increasing would definitely cause some minor warming. But all else is never equal in these situations where there are a multitude of factors all operating out of sync with each other in a chaotic fashion. And that is why virtually everybody who knows anything knows that you cannot predict the future of the global climate with a computer model, for example. Nobody who's capable of understanding the relationships among all these factors in that kind of detail to be able to predict this in a computer model. And all these predictions of runaway climate change are based on computer models. Again, they behave as though a computer model is a crystal ball. Well, actually, the crystal ball is a mythical object. It cannot predict the future any more than a computer model can predict the future. And the truth is, the output from a computer model is absolutely dependent on the inputs that you put into it.
Absolutely.
If you keep putting the same inputs into a computer model, it will never give you a different answer. It will always give you the same answer. And if the inputs you put in are not exactly right, it'll give you the wrong answer every time. And that's why it is foolish to believe people who are depending on computer models to predict the future of planet Earth, which is not the easiest thing. It was Yogi Berra who repeated someone else's statement. I'm not sure it was a scientist back further. But Yogi Berra liked to say predictions are difficult, especially about the future. And he was right about that.
Well, we've got to take a break here, but when we come back...
In a minute and a half.
Oh, in a minute
and a
half. Okay, well, then
it's
I got
Bill's
a question.
Job.
If you have... true or false, the CO2 levels of the planet have been much, much higher in the distance past than they are today. How do we explain that?
Well, in fact, CO2 sunk to the lowest level in the history of the Earth,
mm-hmm.
for those who don't know, is 4.6 billion years. It sunk to the lowest level in the history of the Earth 20,000 years ago at the height of the last glaciation, because that was the coldest it got in the last 100,000 years. And at the height of the glaciation, the oceans get colder and absorb more gases from the atmosphere. So they sucked a lot of the CO2 out of the atmosphere and brought it down to 180 parts per million. Today it's at 400. So, and it's coming out of the ice age, it went back up to 280 from 180. So as the oceans warmed up again, it gave off CO2. The oceans gave off CO2 into the atmosphere. Sorry, this is complicated, but...
Not really. I think really and truly, but for the numbers, we learned these ideas in sixth grade. You know, when you learn about CO2 and how it makes plants grow.
But we've been wrong this
time. No, we've been wrong the whole time. We have to take a really quick break. We're going to come back and we're going to chat some more about CO2 with our super special guest, Dr. Patrick Moore. And you're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. Under the sea, under the sea, nobody beat us, fry us, and eat us in fricassee. We want the land for snug to cook. Under the sea, we have to hook up. We got no trouble. Land with the bubbles under the sea.
Under the sea.
Under the sea. Seems like this video. We got the...
That was for Dr. Moore.
Yeah. We couldn't help it. He had to throw in a little mermaid for you.
Because we're talking to a doctor who understands ocean acidification and sea rise and all these things that we keep hearing about from people like Alexandria O'Communist. And these things that we're talking about on the show today on We the People Radio with Dr. Patrick Moore, Aaron Ryan, and Bill Cundiff and Debbie Rajagalupi.
I'm not near as qualified to talk about that as...
As she is,
because, you know, she was a bartender, and they talk to a lot of people.
They do.
And a lot of qualified people are in there drinking. And
everybody knows when you've been drinking, everybody sounds smarter.
Oh, yeah.
But I think the average person like me, who's, you know, when I go into a room with Dr. Patrick Moore, in fact, Dr. Patrick Moore, you're going to be speaking coming up at a conference that I am so honored to be a part of, and it's called Doctors for Disaster Preparedness. So, guys, look up online, Doctors for Disaster Preparedness. And I'm telling you, when I walk into that room, the whole IQ of the room is just going to drop.
Well, you have that to look forward to.
But, you know,
well, I appreciate it.
But something, Dr. Moore, that you're famous for, and I've seen your presentations. I was with you at the Paris conference, and where we had all those protesters protesting, all these great scientists like yourself. Dr. Bill Carter and Dr. Willie Soon. It was just a great lineup of people. As they want to refute your science, and one of your areas of expertise is, you know, this thing called ocean acidification. Can you tell us a little bit about it and what propaganda is being put out there that, you know, we could start as just common human beings, not with the IQ of a scientist, can come back and refute and say, hey, wait a minute, that's not true.
Well, you know, at least with global warming and carbon dioxide, there is this hypothesis that because CO2 is a greenhouse gas, it will cause a little warming. But with ocean acidification, you've actually got a complete 100% fabrication. There is no basis for this so-called hypothesis. Because what they're saying is that the ocean will absorb more CO2. If we put more CO2 into the atmosphere, the ocean will absorb more CO2. And that is a distinct possibility. However, I was mentioning before the break that CO2 is now the lowest it's ever been in the history of the Earth. So the evolution of life for 3 billion-plus years has taken place with far higher levels of CO2 in the atmosphere. As a matter of fact, CO2 was basically running out before we came along and started burning fossil fuels and putting some of the CO2 back into the atmosphere where it came from in the first place to make the fossil fuels, because they're made from plants. And plants sucked up fossil fuels to make themselves and then got buried and turned into coal and oil and gas. So ocean acidification is based on the idea that with CO2 at one of the lowest it's been in the history of the Earth, too much of it is going to get into the ocean and kill everything. So right off the bat, it's a stupid concept.
Yeah, that doesn't make sense.
Is that also part of the coral bleaching argument?
Oh, yeah. They always talk about that.
No, that's blamed on heat, that the ocean is too hot for the coral. But the problem with that argument is the area they've been focusing on is the Great Barrier Reef. And the Great Barrier Reef is actually not the hottest ocean in the world. The hottest ocean in the world is the oceans around Indonesia and the Philippines. And that is where the highest diversity of corals and reef fish exist on this planet. So if the highest diversity of corals and the highest diversity of reef fish exist in the hottest ocean on Earth, what are they doing telling us that the oceans are getting too hot? Because we know for a fact that when the Earth was hotter, corals spread over a much larger area of the globe. Now they're confined pretty much to deep equatorial zones.
Hmm.
The fact is, coral can live in much warmer climates than it does now, but I see that the AOC Green New Deal is predicting, and I think the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change of the United Nations is saying the same thing, that 90% of the corals will die if the temperature goes up 2 degrees. Well, the temperature going up 2 degrees is nothing compared to how warm the Earth has been for hundreds of millions of years in the past when coral reefs occupied a far larger area. So just by that, we know that ocean acidification is a crock.
So the
main reason for knowing that it's phony is that they're making it seem as if the coral animals, like these are called the marine calcifiers, like coral reefs and shellfish, coccolithophores, which are a phytoplankton that make calcium carbonate shells for themselves, they're acting as though that calcification process is taking place in the sea. It is not. It is taking place inside these organisms where they control their internal biochemistry.
Oh.
And they can control their internal biochemistry like a muscle growing near the shoreline where a river comes out, where you have vast changes in pH, in salinity, in oxygen content, and every other thing. They survive there with a huge fluctuation in different ocean parameters. So there's no reason that this would affect all the species of coral and calcifying species in the sea in any different way. It's a complete fabrication. It's totally made up. It has no basis in fact, and you don't actually hear a lot about it anymore since I wrote my paper, peer-reviewed, double-blind paper, showing that it was a complete fabrication about 4 years ago.
So what?
But they still talk about it.
So what's causing the coral bleaching, or is it even happening?
Coral bleaching is caused when the ocean heats up to an extreme temperature above 30 degrees Celsius for a period of time. And most people don't know, but corals are a symbiotic relationship between an animal and a plant. The polyp, which is the animal, is living inside the coral, and a little hole where it comes out, its tentacles come out at night, and it feeds, just like many marine species do. They have tentacles that come out and feed on plankton in the sea. But corals also take in plankton into their bodies, plankton of a particular species. The thing that makes coral a color is the plankton inside them. Because the animal in there, plankton being a plant, of course, so they're a combination of an animal and a plant. The animal is clear. It has no color. So when the polyp ejects the plankton when it's hot, this is what happens during bleaching, is they eject their plankton, then the coral becomes white because they are basically see-through, and the coral is made of calcium carbonate, which is white. And so you see the skeleton, it looks like a skeleton of the coral, when in fact living animals are still inside there. And when the water cools down, they take the plankton back in. The color of the coral is dependent on the species of the plankton that it is taken in. They're extremely selective in that way. They don't just take in any old phytoplankton. They take in a species that they prefer, and the plankton then is doing photosynthesis and giving them sugar. In return, the zooplankton gives the phytoplankton, the plant, protection from predators because it's inside the polyp.
Sure.
So it's a complicated thing. Coral reefs are an amazing creature that has done this and creates these huge, I call it calcium carbonate reefs, which is what limestone is made from. Limestone, marble, and chalk are all of life origin, made by marine calcifying species, which learn to do this, many different species. You know, it's crabs and shrimp and lobsters and clams and mussels and barnacles. and all the shellfish and the corals, and then there's a number of zooplankton and phytoplankton, which are so extremely small people don't know about them, that the foraminifera and the coccolithophores, the former a zooplankton, an animal, the latter a phytoplankton, a plant, also make calcareous shells for themselves. So many marine species learned to make armor plating out of calcium carbonate to protect their soft bodies from predation. And as a result, they are combining carbon dioxide with calcium in the water and pulling CO2 out of the ocean. And when the plants and animals that do this die, their skeletons fall on the bottom and form the limestone, marble, and chalk deposits that amount to 8% of the Earth's crust. This has been going on for 500 million years.
This is fascinating.
And I could go on for 500 million years, too, but please don't let me.
No. My gosh. I want to go down scuba diving right now. I'm not kidding. I'm like itching to go scuba diving, Dr. Moore. And check
you
out
go to Indonesia. Go to the Komodo Islands from Bali and over to Flores, or go up into Raja Ampat in Papua, which used to be called Irian Jaya. And now called Papua. It's part of Papua, where Papua New Guinea is the eastern end of it and Papua is the western end of it. Up in there, you just go into the Coral Triangle anywhere. The Solomon Islands are included. The Philippines are included. And pretty much the whole of the eastern part of the Indonesian Sea is included. And that is where the highest diversity of corals and rockfish are, the reef fish are. And if you go there and spend a week snorkeling there, you will wonder if heaven could be any better.
Oh,
see, and all this scare tactic, you know, that we're killing the ocean and bleaching the coral and this and that, it plays really well because most people haven't seen that themselves. And so they're just taking these folks' word for it. And we all, what's his name, Jim? What's his name? He always talks about...
Oh, Hansen.
No, Jim, the other one, the funny one. And he always talks about it's fear porn. He said, you know, people have just gotten addicted to fear porn on all this stuff. They just like to be scared. So they give them a bad scenario, and they just keep reading more about how bad it is.
Well, whether it's sea rise or plastic in the ocean or coral bleaching or ocean acidification.
Oh, we're currently sitting in a state that banned straws. We're going to save the world by banning drinking straws. We've got to take
The presentation I'm giving at the Doctors for Disaster Preparedness in July in Tucson is titled 12 Fake Invisible Catastrophes and Threats of Doom.
Nice.
Can't wait.
Classic.
My hypothesis is that because people can't see things that are invisible, like CO2 and whatever's supposed to be bad inside GM food and radiation from nuclear reactors, they can't see that, so people can make up stories however they want about all of that that's going on. And even really remote things like polar bears and coral reefs, who can go and count the coral reefs and the polar bears and check out their health? So when things are invisible or remote, we depend on activists and scientists who are on the government payroll and media to tell us what's going on. We can't see for ourselves. And so that's why most of these scare stories are about things that are invisible or remote.
Exactly. We're going to take a really quick break. Our guest is Patrick Moore, Dr. Patrick Moore. He is a PhD in ecology with the Institute of Resource Ecology and the University of British Columbia back in 1972. So, and it got really quiet all of a sudden. You're listening to We the People. Join us online at wethepeopleradio.us. is going to be a nice, bright, sunshiny day one of these days. We're having protracted rain here. Dr. Moore, can you go? Do you want to talk a little bit about your erasure from history before we run out of time? I mean, we've got some time left, but because that's a very interesting phenomenon. If you pipe up against the established environmental machinery, they erase you regardless of your knowledge or your history in the movement or any of that. You just got eliminated from, isn't it Wikipedia or something?
Wikipedia and Google.
You're now not involved. You never had any involvement with Greenpeace, even though you started it.
Well, they're basically ashamed of me because I'm telling the truth.
That's why we like you.
So, historical revisionism is as old as the hills. You know, and George Orwell understood that in his book 1984, where he basically says, you know, if you control the past, you control the present, and if you control the present, you control the future. And what these people are doing is they are basically trying to erase the fact that I was one of the founding directors of Greenpeace and on the first voyage of Greenpeace, and then, unlike anyone else, spent the next 15 years in their leadership going as we evolved into an international organization. My last 6 years, where I was still president of Greenpeace Canada during that period because it was one of the national organizations, I was also one of five directors of Greenpeace International. And so I was in the top committee for those 15 years, and not many other people survived that at either a life level or a political level, which, because you can imagine the internal politics in an organization like that. And so, the thing that bothers me the most is Wikipedia will not let the subject of their biography, a living person, contribute to their own biography without going through all these committees, whereas other people just can come in and change your biography and then have to defend it later. And that's what's happened recently with my biography, is they have got some kind of adjudication out of these bunch of leftists who edit the Wikipedia website that, on balance, I'm not really a founder of Greenpeace, and they've changed my PhD from ecology to forestry. Now, I'd be perfectly happy to have a PhD in forestry, but my PhD is actually in ecology, so I think I should be allowed to have that in my biography. And there's a whole bunch of other stuff in there. They color every single thing about me negatively. And so I've got to figure out now how to get into Wikipedia and get that changed, because the reason Google took me off the list of the founders of Greenpeace is because Wikipedia did. And Google has some kind of algorithm that goes out into the cloud and collects this information from what's in Wikipedia, I think.
And
I'm
you
not
know
sure
any,
how they,
anyone you
how
know
they
I,
do that.
I love this example, just like I love that we have Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez now, because without AOC, you know, we've been piping up for years and years, you included, Dr. Moore, about this, you know, this radical agenda for the 21st century. And now that, you know, she's come out, she's made our work easier for us. And same with Wikipedia, because I, the other day, went into the history section of Wikipedia, one of the tabs, and you can compare current versions of the Wikipedia for Greenpeace, for example, to older versions. And I went back to 2018, and sure enough, it says that you were one of the co-founders and, you know, a critic of Greenpeace, a co-founder and a critic of Greenpeace. I think, if I remember correctly, now in 2019, they have you as just a critic of Greenpeace.
He was a blasphemer, so, you know.
And so, you know, all these I like to call them anti-human humans, because they truly are against, you know, truth and some of us human beings. You know, it just gives an opportunity for people to do an easy research for themselves to find out how what we're saying is actually true. We're not making this up. This is not hype. They are trying to erase you.
Yes, that's right. And, you know, I was going to mention, though, that I'm really happy you have a sponsor who sells tractors, because I'm huge on ag and farmers. Most people, I think, believe their food comes from the supermarket, but I'm much more aware of that they actually have farms out there in the country where they're toiling every day in different weather conditions, and, you know, they put farmers down almost, and yet farmers probably know more about the weather and the climate than any other category of people on Earth. But what really makes me laugh about the AOC things is I bet those tractor people are really looking forward to the battery-powered tractors and combines they're going to have to
use solar power
to grow the food one of these days, you know. And also the battery-powered semi-trailer trucks that have to carry 40 tons of food into the middle of New York City so that people don't starve to death in their high-rise there.
Well, it's funny, it's funny you mentioned that because here, I think it was two or three years ago, UC Davis came out with a program where their students were going to, they had the farming thing all figured out, and they knew how to do it better than the actual farmers, and they were going to go out and prove it and raise crops in a much more efficient manner. A sustainable manner. And I don't think that program lasted much past a year, and they realized, my God, I've got to get my hands dirty. And I've got to work hard, and it's hot, sweaty work, and maybe you guys know how to do it better than we do. And they dropped the whole thing. You don't hear anything about it now. It's amazing.
Well, it's too bad what's happened to the universities. At least when I went to university, was I hate to tell you how long ago that was, but I was lucky. I had really good costs, and I got a really decent education, and ahead of my PhD committee, quoting a famous Canadian who said, get out of the ivory tower and get into the control tower. And so that really affected me. I realized I should, instead of just going back into teaching after I've been taught, because they do say something about that, or about how those who can do and those who can't teach. I mean, it's not a very nice thing to say, but I wanted to learn how to do things and to get out into the real world and figure things out. And I've been very lucky in being able to do that and to have had quite a few different roles as time has gone along in many different areas. After I left Greenpeace, it's 33 years now, and I've done a lot of things that I've really enjoyed. And it's actually kind of nice now to get a little bit of media after being in the woodshed for a long time, because I was the main spokesman for Greenpeace for many, many years. And when I left, I got kind of shut out by the mainstream. But now I find that it's only the fake news that's saying I'm not a founder of Greenpeace. And, of course, the anti-everything eco people, the so-called green people. But I'm being recognized as the co-founder of Greenpeace in many platforms and many media and blogs, and so that's quite gratifying.
Yeah.
Well, I'm curious. Your book, Confessions of a Greenpeace Dropout, The Making of a Sensible Environmentalist, is I'm sure a must read. I don't have it yet, so I'm assuming it's in the book. But we've got, you know, 2 or 3 minutes here till we have to take another break. And I was just curious if you could kind of give us the elevator speech on why you left. You know, I mean, what were the, because, I mean, I'm 57, so I kind of saw a little bit of what Greenpeace was doing. But for people who weren't paying attention or who maybe are too young, 30 years ago, how did they go off the rails in your mind? Like, what was it made you want to walk away?
You know, when we started, we had a very strong humanitarian orientation to save human civilization from all of nuclear war, which we also realized would be an environmental catastrophe at the same time. So we combined green and peace, with green being the environment and peace being human civilization living peacefully together. And so as time went on and we saved the whales and got into the baby seals and the toxic waste, somehow the peace sort of got dropped off and all there was left was the green. And by the time I left in the mid-80s, human beings were being characterized as the enemies of nature, the enemies of the Earth, as if we were from Mars or something. When in fact, the first rule of ecology is that all life is one, evolved from the same life in the beginning. And we're no different than the other species in that sense. We're not like some kind of alien being. And to suggest that humans are the only bad species is way too much like original sin for me, and I'm not into that sort of way of thinking about people, that we're the only bad thing on the planet. And so that was the high level. The sharp end of the stick, though, was my fellow directors decided that Greenpeace should adopt its next campaign to ban chlorine worldwide. I said, you guys, it's one of the elements in the periodic table, you know.
Like, chlorine.
I'm not sure we can be banning one of those. But more importantly, adding chlorine to drinking water and our swimming pools and spas was the biggest advance in the history of public health to prevent waterborne communicable diseases from spreading. And most of our synthetic pharmaceuticals, medicines, are made with chlorine chemistry, because it's toxic to bacteria, and therefore the most important element for medicine. And so it fell on deaf ears with, you know, they just said, oh, we'll figure that out later, you know. And so they embarked upon a campaign to ban chlorine worldwide, and I left because I could not be in an organization that was campaigning on something so stupid as that.
You get down to the part where you start looking around and go, I think these guys might be dummies. Huh, well, that's a good reason to leave. That makes perfect sense.
You're not kidding. Today, they've morphed into like a bunch of college kids on a summer cruise, let me tell you. They've got a $32 million boat, and they're floating around the world on it pretending it's a sailboat when it has an 1,850-horsepower diesel engine in it.
Uh-oh.
And we had like a $40,000 boat, and we saved the whales with it, you know.
We've got to take a really quick break, but I'll tell you what, the mocking on that topic could go on forever.
It could.
Really, really quick break here. You're listening to We the People Radio. Our guest is Dr. Patrick Moore. You can find everything about the program and listen to the archive after and send it to a friend. You can get it at wethepeopleradio.us.
Me and all my friends, we're all misunderstood. They say we stand for nothing, and there's no way. Now we see everything that's going wrong with the world and those who lead it. We just feel like we don't have the means to rise above and beat it. So we keep waiting, waiting, waiting on the world to change. We keep on waiting, waiting, waiting on the world to change.
Tell you what, the silliness goes on and on and on. So what other, if we could here in this last segment, if there's one other part that, you know, if you were king for a day and you could just, you know, give everyone an injection so they could figure out this one thing, what would you pick, Dr. Moore?
I would say that carbon dioxide is the building block of life, the currency of life on this planet, and is not a pollutant, and they should stop demonizing it because they got it exactly 100% backwards. The fact of the matter is all life on Earth is carbon-based. The carbon in all carbon-based life comes from one and only one molecule, and that is carbon dioxide in the air and in the water. All the carbon dioxide came from the interior of the Earth when it was much hotter through volcanic action, in the same as the water did. H2O and CO2 are combined by plants to make sugars like glucose, which is a carbohydrate, carbon, hydrate, water. Those two are the most important building blocks of all life. And the sugar is the basis of the energy for all life, including ourselves and the birds and everything else. So carbon dioxide is the central molecule in life. And as far as we know, the life on this earth is the only life in the universe. You can guess all you want that maybe there's another million planets with life on them somewhere, but we don't know of one. This is the only one we actually know of. So if we were reasonable in our thinking, I'm not saying we should worship carbon dioxide, but we should certainly give it its rightful place in the scheme of things, which is that it is the building block of life, and we should be knowledgeable of that.
And why is that so? I mean, okay, so Leighton Stewart was on our program a bunch of years ago, actually, and he was talking about CO2, and he had said, he had told us, really simple math, 400 parts per million of CO2 in the regular air as we're standing around. But if somebody were to drop on the ground and you did mouth-to-mouth resuscitation on them, you would breathe into them 40,000 parts per million of CO2. And so if CO2 is a pollutant, everyone we ever did mouth-to-mouth resuscitation on should have died instantly, and yet they did not. And every
that
time
is
I...
That is correct. Our breath is 1,000 times when we exhale, is 1,000 times the level of the CO2 that we breathed in, because we take in oxygen and oxidize the sugars and the starches and the fats which we make from the sugars in our bodies and breathe out carbon dioxide as a waste product from us ourselves as animals. And then that waste product feeds the plants. So the Earth's life system has evolved into a beautiful cycle where the plants use CO2 to make sugars, and then we eat the sugars, and we make CO2 back for the plants again. They make the oxygen for us. There was no oxygen in the atmosphere until plants evolved. It is purely a life made substance in the atmosphere, whereas carbon dioxide came from the middle of the earth, as did water. But the oxygen in the atmosphere came from living things, and it's the only reason we can survive. If people don't understand that very fundamental aspect of the water and the oxygen and the carbon dioxide, I mean, then something's really wrong. And, you know, the problem is the politicians, right at the top end of it, the Greens create the scare stories in the media, but the politicians pay the scientists to give them scare stories dressed up in sciencey stuff so that they can scare the people into voting for them on the basis that they're going to save their kids and grandchildren from a terrible end in fire and brimstone. Like this idea that the world is going to end in 12 years are there three people out of the 7.5 billion who actually believe that? I just can't understand how many people fall for this stuff. The truth is, though, is that in a poll that was done very recently, out of 20 issues that are top-of-mind issues in the public, climate change was number 18. And from what I understand, the average, when most people are asked of how much they would spend to solve this problem, is like $10. No, people really don't like carbon taxes, and they don't like to have to pay. On the other hand, the climate catastrophe, climate crisis people make them feel guilty for driving their SUV, so they feel guilty that they're going to kill their grandchildren, and they're afraid. So fear and guilt together is what the climate thing is all about, and fear and guilt together opens people's wallets. And so it's really just, it is a racket, the whole thing. It's not just a hoax and a scam. It's an actual racket.
It is. If you go back, if you can find a copy of Al Gore's Inconvenient Truth, you could almost go page by page and debunk every single thing he predicted in that book, because it's already come to pass. The timelines that he's put on all that stuff has already come and gone, and none of it happened. So you would think that people would kind of take a step back and go, wow, maybe this isn't true.
Maybe he's a dum-dum.
Well, yep. Here we are again now with OAC or AOC. AOC or
Alexandria O'Communist.
O'Communist, yes. Now here we are again. 12 years from now, we're all going to die. I'm with you. I don't think there's a whole lot of people out there that believe any of it. But yet, here we are.
But the frightening part is, well, Debbie and I were looking for music for a group of shows that we've pre-recorded here. We were looking for music, and I swear almost, well, I'm going to say 90% of the songs that are online that are about the environment are being sung by children.
Yeah, it was overwhelming, and the views have been like 30 million to 100 million.
Mm-hmm. Well, they're the little kids.
The little kids are the educators.
And just coming back, sorry to not give Dr. Moore some time here in these last few seconds here.
You'll miss 2.5 minutes.
But, you know, I just got back from the most recent United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, and Dr. Moore, I cannot express to you how many young people were at this conference, and like you, I've been to several of these conferences, And,
they all drove there.
We
right?
were shocked at how many and teenagers and elementary school students that, you know.
Yes, but they are being brought there by adults like Al Gore.
Absolutely. Yep.
And this is absolutely child abuse, what they are doing. It's worse than child abuse, if you could find anything worse than that. Because this is what Nazis do. This is what communists do. They use children and they get them to sing songs about the great Hitler youth and all of that, you know. This is what they're doing. They're using children to appeal to people because people love children. And then when children are taught to do doomsday stories, you know, and this thing about, you know, Al Gore and all his predictions not come true. The problem is people have a memory of about 10 years. So somebody says, we have 10 years to save the world from doom. 10 years goes by, doom doesn't happen. They say, oh, yes, but we only have 10 more years to save the world from doom.
It's a cycle.
David Suzuki, who is a famous Canadian environmental catastrophe guy, has done it four times in his lifetime. They just keep repeating it. And it's been actually repeated throughout the ages. The end is nigh. A guy standing on the corner with a sign that says the end is nigh has been going on for thousands of years, and it never comes true. Yes, there are wars and horrible circumstances, but those are caused by bad people. And the people who are driving their cars and putting CO2 into the atmosphere are actually returning a balance to the global carbon cycle by fertilizing the plants. And that's why we have to turn this whole narrative completely on its head, because it's 100% backwards. Carbon dioxide is entirely beneficial to both the planet, the environment, and to civilization, because it will make our food crops grow faster, and it will make the earth greener. So it's good all around. There's nothing bad about it. And if it does make the planet a slight bit warmer, that will be good, too, because this is one of the coldest periods in the history of planet Earth. If you go back hundreds of millions of years, it's been warmer than it is today 99% of the time, and life flourished on this planet all through those warm periods. This is a fact.
Well, we appreciate the time. We are flat out of time, but I hope people will go to wethepeopleradio.us and read your article, The Positive Role of Human Emissions of CO2.
And get his
book!
And
we've been visiting with Dr. Patrick Moore. Thank you so much. We really appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you. I love your music policy, by the way.
Outstanding. We'll have you back anytime.
All right.
Good afternoon, and welcome to the second hour of We the People Radio. Today is June 2nd, 2019, just in case you're listening to this at a different day. Sometimes we play things on the archive, like we did today. So our guest today is Lawrence Mead. Sorry, I made him a doctor. He's a professor, so that's close enough. But I think you're going to like this. It's going to be an interesting hour for you. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
So I changed it up a little.
All right.
Bill's like, you forgot to introduce yourself. I was like, no.
Who the heck are you?
I don't know. I just changed it around.
Okay.
Otherwise, it's boring, and everybody already knows what we're going to say, and they don't listen.
Keep them guessing.
Yeah. So the program is We the People. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us. The handy part of the website, for one, is all the guest information is there. And if you're thinking, wow, how come they're not on this other channel and this other station and this other show, blah, 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 all the information on how to book them is also on there, which is good. And you can also find the archive of the programs that we have done for the past 10 years that are all listed commercial-free for your listening enjoyment and doesn't cost you a cent. So, a lot to be grateful for there. Thanks, Robert, for all your hard work. All right, so let's jump right into this because I think this is a really interesting topic, and we have never spoken to Lawrence Mead before. He's a professor of politics and public policy at New York University, and you're thinking, oh, man, the guy's from New York. He's going to be a crackpot. No, he's not.
We got that out of the way.
I grew up in Connecticut. See, it's like it's really good when people like you are on, because it's like, no, not everybody back there is a crackpot. He is the author of a new book called Burdens of Freedom. The subtitle is Cultural Difference in American Power. And he's been a visiting professor at Harvard, Princeton, and the University of Wisconsin. Had a little cheese before we came here. Every time I hear the word Wisconsin, I like my mouth starts, you know, thinking about cheese. Also been a visiting fellow at Princeton and at the Hoover Institution at Stanford. So frequent media guest. He's been on all sorts of giant radio programs, just like this one. And, oh, gosh, been in the New York Times again. We won't hold that against you. Washington Post, The Economist. He's an expert on the problems of poverty and welfare in the United States. And among academics, he was the principal exponent of work requirements in welfare, the approach that now dominates national policy. And, you know, we love our friend Stephen Manfredi, because he sends us all these fun authors. And I did list the questions that he gave us, so just in case we were complete knuckleheads.
That's what I'm here for. I'm here to keep you on track.
He did give us 10 fun questions to ask you, but we don't actually have to do that if we don't want to. We do have an hour with you, so we're happy to do this however you would like. And do you go by Lawrence, or are you a Larry?
Larry is fine.
You're a Larry. See, because we have a William call me Bill, so I'm like, we might have a Lawrence call me Larry. So
yeah.
All right. Well, this really sounded like a very timely book, for starters. Something that we really should be thinking about, you know, individualism versus collectivism. And we're fighting about that a lot, although I'm not sure people put it in that context.
Well, I don't think that they probably mean by collective something different from what I mean by it. I'm primarily interested in the contrast between an individualist culture and a collective-minded culture where people don't think that they're individuals. That's not really about politics or policy. So a collective society with a big government, collective in that sense, could still be an individualist society in a cultural sense. And I think on the whole, that is the case with the United States. We do have a sizable government that many view as collective, excessively big or whatever, and there's a lot of political conflict about how big government should be. But that isn't really my focus. My focus is on whether the culture is individualist or collective, and especially whether it's becoming more collective-minded.
Right.
That's my main concern.
Yeah, we've always been an individualist culture, I think.
I mean, but
it's changing.
But not in the way that I think a lot of our detractors say, well, you guys are all about the individual thinking that we don't care about other people.
Caring about other people is an important aspect of individualism.
Right.
We have a moralistic sense of right and wrong, and one of the dictates of that moralism is to care about people in trouble, and we feel we should help them, and we want government to help them. So that isn't, the individualism doesn't mean that government doesn't care. It does, however, place a premium on people helping themselves. And these things are not seen in conflict. If you're helping yourself, then you become more deserving, and you might ask more from government than if you weren't helping yourself. And that actually is the way the public views it. The public is upset by welfare programs, not because they're costly or because they're helping people, but because they don't expect people to help themselves.
Well,
they want there to be reciprocity. So that's where you see the characteristic moralism.
Sure, and I think people are also frustrated that, you know, for instance, we have a huge gap on how we deal with our veteran population in this country. And then you match that up to how we're dealing with our illegal immigrant population, how we're dealing with our prison population. And so we're looking at, you know, some people are literally riding for free. Other people have made sure that other people can ride for free, and they're getting nothing. It's like, wait a second. So there's a fundamental sense of fairness, I think, built in, baked into our cake.
Yeah, Americans care that everyone bears what I call the burdens of freedom. They have to bear the responsibilities that go with living in a free society. And those things include helping yourself, figuring out your own direction, doing what you can to help yourself, and so on. Above all, living out your own goals. That's primarily what individualism means. And we become uneasy when we encounter people who are more passive, who seem not to care about that, who are going with the flow, who live from day to day. They're engaging in survival, not engaging in achievement. That is what disturbs us. That is the way of the non-Western world. And that has its own virtues, but that isn't what America's about on the whole.
No, and I think that's also what freaks people out about the idea that we have a group of people in the 20-something age range, typically, who have decided, well, let's see, I went to school and I, you know, actually have a college degree and I could go get a job, but I think I'm just going to live on the street. I think I'm just going to sit around and, you know, do nothing and enjoy my life and get what I can for free.
Well, if you decide that you want to live a certain life and that and it comes out in that direction, then that actually wouldn't be counter to an individualist idea of what life's about. We all seek to work out our salvation with fear and trembling, to use a biblical phrase. We try to find the way that is best for us. And the struggle to find your way forward on your own is actually crucial to the society's dynamism. It's that quality that creates ferment, change, improvement, various shifts in opinion about things. Society is not stable because everyone's working out their way forward. And so that the struggle to find your way is really crucial to the society's dynamism. And whereas that isn't what you find in the non-Western world, those societies are not dynamic. They're stable. They tend to defer to authority. People have an idea of what life requires of them, and they follow that. They don't seek out their own idea of what life requires of them. So the society doesn't engage in constant, broad-based improvement. That isn't the thing that goes on. There can be improvement. There can be change, but it's dictated by the leaders. The leaders decide to change a certain direction, and that's where the society goes. But in the West, the dynamism is from the bottom up, and the leaders on the whole are leading others who have already moved in a certain direction. So that's why society in the West has always been so much more productive than is characteristic of the rest of the world.
There's just so much behind all that. And there's so much to think about. Okay, Stephen's first question is a pretty good one. You know, why did you write the book? Let's do that when we come back from our break. Because, okay, now we're curious about it. He was right. We should have started with his questions.
No.
But see, he told us to do it. You know, I mean, it was right there, like directions. And so, of course,
There goes your individualism. I'm going to do it my way.
My natural inclination is, well, heck, we don't need these stupid things. Oh, my gosh. We will be back with our guest, Larry Mead. We're going to call him Larry. And you are a doctor. Yeah. I read the bottom of your bio. You have a PhD.
Yeah.
So he is a doctor. Yeah. All right. We'll be back with Dr. Mead. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. Ultimate song for the individual. All right, Dr. Mead, why did you write the book?
Why did I write it?
Well,
mainly to work out some answers to questions I've struggled with for a long time. The three that are most important, first of all, poverty in America, especially long-term poverty. I spent much of my career figuring out how to deal with that. It's a mystery why people can be poor for a long time in a rich country where jobs are available. We don't really have a good explanation for that, at least not in terms of social barriers. I came to the conclusion that basically poverty of this sort is really due to cultural difference. Most of those who are poor long term come from the non-Western world. And what we're seeing here is an example of surviving behavior, where people are just getting through the day. They're not pursuing a goal. They don't see themselves as in charge of anything or going anywhere. And it's that temperament, that passive reactive temperament, which is actually the main reason that they're poor. I'm not saying that isn't understandable coming where they're from, or rather coming where they're coming from. But it doesn't get you anywhere in America. This is not the way most Americans live. And if you try to live that way, you don't get very far.
Right.
So that's
right.
The point. That's the first thing. The second thing is the problem of immigration, where we have dealt with large numbers of people coming into the country, and we're having a much, much harder time assimilating those groups than we did 100 years ago when we had the previous large-scale wave of immigration. And the difference is, I think, that the previous wave came mostly from Europe, and so the people were coming in with an individualist viewpoint. So they understood life as a project. They understood that when they came to America, they had to work out a direction and make their own way. And so that was why they assimilated rather easily. Today's Inuits, however, are coming mostly from the non-Western world, chiefly from Asia and Latin America. And in those societies, you don't have an individualist temperament. You have people who think life is about survival, who don't have long-term goals, who orient more to outside constraints and demands than they do to their own direction. So they bear what I call the burdens of necessity. They're really not bearing the burdens of freedom. And so that's why they have a hard time in America. They really encounter difficulties which are, I think, explicable from cultural difference. And the third issue is the problem of failed states. One of my main interests in graduate school a long time ago was to figure out how countries that are new, that have just come out of the European empires and become independent countries, what's going to happen to them politically. Back then, we assumed that they would progress towards Western forms of government, they would become democratic, they would have strong institutions. It wouldn't happen overnight, but there would be progression in this direction. Well, this hasn't happened. Many countries in the developing world are worse off today than they were under the empires. The quality of government is poor, and in the worst cases, countries are literally falling apart. They can't govern themselves. There's chaos. You see this in Somalia, for example. How does that happen? How is it that those countries are unable to govern themselves, whereas the Western world has had strong government for a very long time? We've had good government, and there's almost no country, only a few countries outside the Western world, which are really well governed at all. So there's something there, too, that I think is due to cultural difference.
So getting back to your second point there about immigration and folks coming in, and most of those are going to fall in the lower income scale.
The way we have
with
it
a non-individualism attitude. And you couple that with our social structure and social welfare programs, doesn't that hinder them even more and make it almost impossible for them to get out of that, I don't know, line of thinking?
Well, a lot of people think that, and I used to think that myself. I used to be one of those who criticized welfare for making it easy for people not to work and otherwise get ahead. But I've come to the view that it's mostly cultural. That is, we could abolish the welfare state tomorrow. We could indeed abolish all of government tomorrow, and it would have very little effect on the long-term poor. Mm-hmm. They would not suddenly become individualists. They would not suddenly say that they're responsible for themselves, because that isn't what they believe now, and they're not likely to change that just because government does more or less for them. And in the last 50 years, when poverty has been an issue, we've tried all kinds of different approaches to try to reach this group and motivate it to begin to get ahead, and we really haven't been able to do it. We've had some successes, but in general, we haven't found a way to cause the long-term poor to go to work, to assume responsibility, to see their lives as moving forward, and take rational, sensible things to do to move in that direction. We haven't seen that.
Right.
And the reason is that the burdens of freedom are too much for them. To go to work is to assume responsibility for something. And that is very hard. Individual responsibility is a core Western notion, and that is something that we really don't see in the non-Western world. Mm-hmm. We see a much more collective, more passive, reactive idea of what life's about. And that doesn't work in America. You don't find that same collective identity. You're on your own. You have to decide what to do. The opportunities are much better than they were in the old country, but they make demands that you can face them.
Right. So what's the answer? I mean, we have these massive amounts of people coming into the country that are in that very group that will get by a lot easier in our country than they can in their own, but it still doesn't give them the motivation to become individuals. So
The very idea of motivation assumes that you yourself conceive a desire to go and do something, and that isn't the way of the non-West in general. They're waiting for orders. They expect to be told what to do.
Right.
And what I've done in my previous research, I've written several books about this, is to suggest that actually for the seriously poor, we have to tell them what to do. Rather than offer incentives or alternatively to deny benefits, those things don't actually give them what they need, which is direction. So actually a directive policy is more effective. And that's what we did in welfare reform. The reason why welfare reform is so successful, I think, and there were a number of reasons why it succeeded, but the core reason, I think, was because we did tell people what to do. We said, you have to go to work now. You can't just draw aid. We'll help you. We're not against helping you. But you must also help yourself. You have to go out and get a job.
And we help them do that.
Right, but we don't do that now. Now we...
Well, yes, we do. In the program that we reformed, what's now called temporary assistance for needy families, we still have a policy there that says you have to go out and work or look for work if you're drawing aid. Now, there are other welfare programs that don't have those demands, like food stamps or public housing. And there's controversy in Washington now about moving in that direction for those programs. So they would also have work requirements. I would favor that. But the reason why we need the requirements is because this is a fundamentally passive population that isn't going to take action on its own to go out and get ahead. So they have to be told what to do. They'll respond to that more than they do to incentives because they're coming from the non-West. And the non-West, the one thing it has in common, although there's great diversity in the non-West, all those cultures defer to authority. That's very strange for Americans. We obey authority when it's legitimate, but we also question authority. And the capacity to both obey and question is really central to Western achievement. But you don't find that in the non-West. You find deference. So we have to use that. We have to say to people who are poor, people who are immigrants and who aren't making way, we have to say to them, you have to go out and get a job, and your kids have to go to school. And we expect that. And this is not a choice. See, choice is hard. Choice is hard for groups that don't think they're in control of anything.
Mm-hmm.
You can't expect choice. But you can expect compliance. You can say to them, go and do this. Now, this is very different from the reaction you get. I mean, I've been on radio and television shows at the BBC in Britain about their welfare reform. And in the British system, people are much more likely to say that they're entitled to money, that it's wrong for them to have to work. They assert a right to welfare as an entitlement. Well, our recipients don't talk like that. And the reason they don't is they're not Western. It's Westerners who talk like that. They're the ones who assert rights. And that, I mean, it's arrogant, it's excessive. Those people ought to go out and work. You can have an argument with them, but at least you can have an argument with them. They're prepared to stand up for something. They assert something. That's more positive, actually, than what we see from our long-term poor, most of them are silent. Now, they're spoken for by advocates, but the advocates are not themselves poor. The advocates are assuming things.
Right.
They
That's
are responsible
point.
For something, but they're not our problem. It's the people they're speaking for who are silent, who don't react, who don't do anything. See, what's hard to deal with for this group is precisely its passivity.
That's true. That's true.
And it's
gotten even harder. I'm looking at point number six that Stephen had sent us, that you contend the great divide today is between the individualist West and the rest of the world.
Yeah.
But that the fear of racism has long suppressed dialogue.
Yeah,
that's like the boogeyman word of the day. Like if
I know
if they don't want us to talk about it, that you're a racist, and then we're supposed to shut up.
That's right. That's right. In fact, I had great difficulty publishing this book because my previous publishers, who were prominent, I had a number of quite well-published books.
And they used to like you?
They were terrified by the argument. A lot of people are terrified because it's easy to construe cultural difference as simply euphemism for racism. But it isn't at all. My sources, the scholars of cultural difference, they deny this. No, no, it's not about race. This is really a different way of life.
But sometimes race does make us different and not different. See, they always equate the word different with bad, though.
Bad. I'm not asserting that. I'm not asserting that Western culture is superior.
Smart people don't assert different with bad. You know, those are the same word.
Yeah, correct. No, the fear of racism is what has suppressed discussion of cultural difference. And the one thing that Trump has done that's constructive here is simply by refusing to honor those taboos. Trump insists upon talking about cultural difference. He does it in scathing terms that are unduly offensive. I can't support his language at all.
He's a New Yorker, you know, and he's a quintessential New Yorker. How about let's put that fine point on it. And anybody who's dealt with the quintessential New Yorker knows it's just how they do it. It's not they don't like you.
I think there's a lot of truth in that. I think that's right. New York is not for the faint of heart.
No, they like to fight, which is sort of fun.
But it assumes. But if you read accounts of New York politics, let's say 100 years ago, it was a lot more rowdy. It was a lot more offensive than it is today. Why was that? Because everybody back then was an individualist. And whereas now, large parts of New York City, like the rest of the country, are coming from these minority groups that are extremely cautious and deferential. They don't shout. They don't argue. They don't make an issue of things.
Well, besides that, culturally, if you can find a buzzword like racism that makes everybody shut up, you don't actually have to have a good argument.
I know.
You can just throw down and silence them, which is actually kind of handy if you're, you know, trying to do that. We have to take a really quick break. We're going to be back with our guest, Dr. Lawrence Mead. He has written a book called The Burdens of Freedom, Cultural Difference and American Power. We'll be right back.
The mountain is high.
Bust out the windows, put his family on food stamps now. He's a big spender, no food on the table, and the bills ain't paid, cause he's spending on cigarettes and PGA. They'll turn us all into beggars, cause they're easier to please. They're feeding our people that government cheese.
And if you believe that, you should definitely read this book, Burdens of Freedom, Cultural Difference in American Power, by Dr. Lawrence Mead. Because Larry tells us that's actually not correct.
What's not correct? I didn't quite hear that.
Oh, sorry, the government cheese song.
Government cheese, yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
that's making people poor, you know, and keeping them poor.
I see. It doesn't have a big effect. I think, as I said, if those programs are all eliminated, it wouldn't have much effect on the culture of the lower class, which is the real problem. And again, I'm not saying that viewpoint is incorrect in any general sense. It reflects their life experience.
Sure.
But it doesn't get you anywhere. You do, in fact, have to go ahead and take plans and do things that are necessary to get ahead. And you can do that. But it's hard because you have to take more responsibility. You have to decide what your life's about. And that is indeed demanding.
Especially for people who perhaps come here from a culture where that is not part of your upbringing.
And a lot of cultures out there don't assimilate to our culture, our society.
Because we're not giving them any directions.
Right. They come here
we need to do that. But you see, you give direction. The problem with that is it conflicts with our notion that freedom is the answer.
Right.
When you look at how left and right deal with poverty, the disagreement is over whether we should have more government or less, but both sides are selling some version of freedom. And in fact, what has been more effective, according to the evaluations, is directive programs, what I call paternalism, where we help people, but we also say, we tell them what to do. We say, you have to go get a job now, or you have to stay in school,
sure,
or you have to obey the law. And we're unapologetic of demanding that.
Well, and there's a lot of people in that are born and raised in this country that fall into that category as well. I mean, I've hired people that, you know, you can turn them on a project and walk away, and they just know what to do. Other people, they'll do what you say, and then they're dead in the water until you give them something else to do, and then they're good at that. So it's the same thing.
Well, that's right. In fact, one of the interesting things I discuss in the book is that part of the native-born population, the low-income and usually low-education workers who voted for Trump, a lot of them are withdrawing from employment and more or less giving up because they find life too difficult now, and they more or less are just abandoning their goals. But when they do that, they're really going over to a way of life more like the non-Western world. And these are people who previously were individualists.
Mm-hmm.
So this shows you how the life of individual seeking and striving is difficult. And for many people, it's too much.
And do you think that's a reason for people going towards socialism rather than, you know, open market values?
Is that why they looks good?
Nope. You see, the socialists are classic individualist moralists. They're trying to save the world. They have a nostrum. They have a recommendation, and they think socialism is the answer. Well, that's what people believe basically 200 years ago and 100 years ago. I mean, there was a long struggle in Western politics over socialism, but it was a struggle fought by individualists, people who believed in things, and went after them. And we now think they were mostly erroneous, that it didn't work, but they tried hard, and their opponents tried hard, and you had a struggle between both sides believing in something. See, that was individualist. And today, the people who want to return to socialism, like some of the Democratic left, they're individualists too. The problem is that is going to change the mentality of people who are giving up.
Mm-hmm.
It'll mean more money given to them and more redistribution and more programs, but that isn't going to cause them to get anywhere.
Right.
Because they're basically against giving those folks direction and having any kind of requirements and to have a plan. You know, there's no conveyor belt onto society.
No, but the idea of a conveyor belt implies that there's some outside force that
That's
can make you into someone, and that isn't true. You have to decide what you want. And from the very earliest point of research on low-income schools, they found out that the kids who get ahead in these schools, even though they're terrible schools, were kids who believe that they control their future, kids who say, I'm responsible. You know, I did well on this test or I didn't do well on this test. And that is why they get ahead.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in a good school where the students are better prepared and they do better after school and so on, that acceptance of responsibility is automatic. No one questions that, because they've been brought up to bear the burdens of freedom, which include responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
And that is what isn't. You don't serve that by simply spending more on the schools. You have to change the mentality of the students. And in fact, we do have recently. We had some evaluations of schools that have succeeded in doing that, not primarily because they spend more money, but because they're more directive. They tell the students what they're supposed to do. And they also, they don't offer them choices. They tell them, here's what you're supposed to do. And they keep order. And they're quite unapologetic about that. And those schools evaluate well. Now, it's hard to institute schools like that. They're very demanding. They're tough on the teachers, tough on the principals. It's hard to do it. But if you can get a school together like that, then you are, in fact, promoting an individualist way of life.
Sure. And then when those students get out into society, that's what they understand, that if you want to get ahead, you have to have goals and you have to work towards those goals and not, you know, sit back and wait for it to come to you.
That's right. And that is actually unusual. See, the thing, we think it's a universal way of life, and people who don't do that there's something wrong with them. On the contrary, it's the individualists who are outnumbered. People who live a purposeful life are few on a world scale. There aren't very many of them. and the Western world as a whole is vastly outnumbered by the non-Western world. So most people in the world are sitting around waiting for directions.
Mm-hmm.
They're waiting to be told what to do. And that isn't our way of life, and that's why America's running the world, more or less, because we don't take that view.
No.
But it's not as if others can just adopt our viewpoint like that, because it involves a massive psychological change.
Right. Right. That's why we can't go overseas and in the Middle East and expect them to just accept
our... Go wave a magic wand and make them all like
that? How we live. You guys could do the same thing. It's not their culture.
Yeah. Well, now, there are some cases, though, where capable leaders of non-Western countries were able to reform them in a good direction because they took charge and gave direction. I'm thinking of Ataturk, who became the founding director of what is today Turkey. Turkey was created by Ataturk after World War I, and he tried to turn it into a Western country. He didn't get all the way there, but he made some major improvements. Or Lee Kuan Yew, who was basically the creator of Singapore as it is today. Singapore was a totally backward, corrupt country like much of Asia, and he turned it into an almost modern country. And it's still a collective country, still collective-minded, but it's honest, and they don't have corruption, and they are efficient and they earn money and they're prosperous, but that's very unusual. It's uncommon for a non-Western country to be well governed and to be efficient and modern and so on. Some Asian countries have done that, but they have not done it American style. They haven't done it by broad gauge individual initiative and people taking responsibility on a personal basis. They haven't done that. Mm-hmm. They do it from the top down. The leaders tell them what to do.
Right.
Now, they also have the market, they have competition, but it's primarily a top-down society where people are waiting to be told what to do, and they're very good at it, and so they achieve something, and they become rich and powerful. But that's not America. America is a society where people innovate on their own. They're out to improve something. They want to make money, they want to get ahead, they also want to fix problems that they see, and they don't wait around for someone to tell them to do it. They just go and do it. And it's that broad-gauge initiative that historians say is the reason why the West became dominant, why it became capable of running the world.
Well, and I think we see that, though. I mean, we can see it within our own society. When government is supposed to be the one that solves the problem, it takes a really long time, costs a lot of money, oftentimes completely misses the point, solves 20% of the problem, if that, and we're wrapped around the axle forever, and the price increases. But if we allow private industry to do it, if we allow just people to figure it out through their own ingenuity, we wind up with amazing things that revolutionize whole industries.
I guess I don't share that view of government. Government is actually
you should work with them more.
In America by world standards, government in America is one of the best governments in the world, according to the World Bank. There are various indicators they have of governmental quality. The United States is right up there. We're one of the best governed countries in the world.
It's not the governing that I guess I'm in the back of my mind. What I'm thinking of is specifically bringing programs to people, and we have some that are great, but we have others that if you just left it alone and let industry take that over. We would have solved it a long time ago.
That's often true, but you see, the criticism of government is to me reflects an individual's temperament. See, that's moralism. We're attacking government by standards that are universal and demanding.
Yeah,
we expect
true.
Government to excel, and we're not satisfied with mediocrity. And that's correct. We shouldn't be. But that attitude, the government is full of people who are problem solvers. I know a lot of them myself.
They're just not always in charge of anything. Unfortunately, people are relegated to the... Because I meet them, too, and I'm like, man, how come you are not the boss of this?
Well, there are some functions government has that employ people who have relatively unenterprising views of what life's about. They're not problem solvers. They're holding down a job. They're doing something essential, but they're not engaged in changing the world. That is true.
Mm-hmm.
And that's true actually more at the state and local level when you're dealing with routine delivery of public services.
Yeah,
but at
true.
The federal level, there are a lot of people engaging in trying to solve problems and improve government. And government has done some impressive things historically. And that reflects the same attitude that made the country rich.
Right.
So the private sector is great. We have the world's best companies, and we change the world that way. no question about it. But government also does that. You look at the highly efficient aspects of American government. I'm thinking of the armed forces, the Social Security program, the Apollo program that sent a man to the moon.
I'm thinking about the VA.
Well, no, the VA is also a pretty good organization for a massive health program. There are obviously problems, but in fact, we provide health care to the veterans that is, I think, the best in the world, in spite of its limitations. And the veterans are very well treated.
But if they could go into their own communities, they would have the ability to. I mean, the VA has done wonderful things with prosthetics and some of those things that are really specific to care. I take nothing away on that. And some facilities are great, some are not great. But because our veterans, in large part, do not have options, that has given them kind of a monopoly. And the change is very slow and very difficult when you deal with it on the ground. So we have to take a really quick break. I'm sorry on that. My little rant there. When we come back, talk to us about collectivism, because we really just kind of skipped over that, so we could talk about things we like individualism. but I'm not sure we're super smart about collectivism, and it would be nice not to leave that hanging there.
Okay.
We'll be right back with our guest, Dr. Lawrence Mead. He has written a book called Burdens of Freedom, and you are listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
I can't do everything, but I can try. And as I roll along, I begin to find things aren't always just what they seem. I wanna turn the whole thing upside down. I'll find the things they say just can't be found. I'll share this love I find with everyone.
And we're back. Okay, so talk to us about your, as you were writing this and you're comparing the idea of the mentality here in the United States versus a more collectivist idea, what does that mean in your terms?
All right. When I use collectivism, I'm usually referring to a way of life where people are not individualist. That is, doesn't say anything about what government does or doesn't do. Now, the term collectivism is used in Western politics to mean a government that takes over from the private economy, basically, where government tries to run things rather than leaving them to the marketplace. Now, the idea that you could do that and improve things over the market was a leading idea for about 200 years, from really the time of the French Revolution right up to the fall of the wall in Berlin in 1989. So exactly 200 years. Now, that idea had a lot of influence in Europe and some influence in this country. So we did some things in government to regulate the economy and try to manage it through government. We did that in the Depression in the 30s. We did it during World War II, and we did it in a more limited way after that. So government does involve regulation and oversight of the private economy, sometimes for good reasons, sometimes for not good reasons. And that is now been taken up by the Democratic Party. Many of their intellectuals are now saying, let's go back to socialism. But it didn't work in Europe, and it didn't really work in America, because the socialist system is less efficient, fundamentally, than capitalism. And because you don't have people at the top, they're not able to decide how to efficiently use and produce things, as the market can do. So the market, although it has its problems, and you have to worry about fairness and stability and inequality and so on, there are some real limitations to the market, but it is efficient. And and it produces innovation. And it makes society much richer than any socialism has ever succeeded in doing.
It also self-purges. And if nobody wants to buy your product or you're not nice to your customers, we take care of you.
Correct. Yep. So the market has won. That battle has been won by the market, and socialism is really a dead idea. It's coming back primarily because Democrats want to try something new, and they want to, in some way, provide jobs for people that they don't think have jobs now. And, of course, jobs are already available. So this is a fantasy. It's not something I support, certainly not. Although there's something government does, like the armed forces, which have to be collective. There's
sure.
some things that
you can't have an individualist armed forces or literally be shooting each other in a circular
so
firing squad.
There are some functions that government has to provide that you could call socialist. The VA system is like that. It's a public hospital system, basically, for the veterans. And that is inefficient compared to a private system, but it serves other goals, and there's some argument for it. I wouldn't go back to it. We should recognize that socialism failed in the past, and we shouldn't go back that way. But the point I'm making, though, is that those who are pushing this are not necessarily against individualism. They themselves are individualists. They think they have an idea, and they're trying to sell it to the public. That's very individualist. That's what Americans do. They set out their own ideas about how to do things and try to get support. And it's an assertive, moralistic game. That's what politics is all about. So in some ways, I like that. That's what shows that individualism isn't dead. But it's not a solution to the problem of passivity at the bottom of society.
Sure.
That's the problem I'm focusing on. That's the really serious problem. And we shouldn't be distracted from that by nostrums peddled by people at the top.
Yeah, good point. I want to skip to the very last question on our list, that in order for American world leadership to endure, a cultural battle to reinform an individualist America must first be fought and won. And so the nice question here, what can be done to stop the decay of individualism with our own society?
Yeah.
And what practical steps can people take? Because I think that's always nice to give folks that.
Well, the main recommendations that I make is that we should require people who are receiving benefits to work. We did that in welfare reform. It was a big success. We should do it again for men withdrawing from the labor force. They should not be given disability unless they're really disabled. They should be put to work. We should help them also. They have to be retrained. We have to find a better way to do that. We're not abandoning them, but they can't give up. You see, what Americans want to do is help people who are helping themselves. The idea of reciprocity is very important. So people helping themselves, yes, we will help you. But you can't give up. You can't be passive. You can't go over to essentially a non-Western way of life where you're just engaging in survival. That we do not accept. We do not accept passivity. You have to be part of the team. You have to be out there trying to solve problems. And when you do that, when you take on those burdens, then you are contributing to the country.
And see, I think that's where you run into so much kickback is when you say people have to work, you know, to be part of the team.
That makes you mean.
Boy, the alarm bells start ringing at that point. You can't make people work, you know.
So I'll veer off the path here, but I'm just guessing. I already know the answer. But looking at what's happening, not only are you know anybody who's trying to put any common sense in is called a racist, and you know all those other things. Okay, they get called a bunch of names, but with the denigration of men in our society, that's the very popular trend. Is you know men are bad, leadership is bad, so that's not helping our individualism either.
No, it isn't. But the groups that talk like that, or their leaders talk like that, are typically groups, the immigrants, minorities, who are coming from the non-Western world. They're people who are uncomfortable here. They don't find it easy to live in an individualist society. So their fatalism, their pessimism, is expressed by the leaders. The leaders, by the way, are not unsuccessful. On the contrary, they're usually very successful.
Right.
These are talented people who are asserting themselves. They're thoroughly American. But what they're arguing for is not American. It's a passivity. It's what they basically say, my group is helpless. We're totally
victims.
Dominated by the society. Well, that is not American. That is the voice of the non-West. That's what people feel like who assign all power to the environment rather than to themselves. And much of the world does feel that way, and it's understandable. I'm not saying that's crazy. in general. But it is crazy in America. That isn't what this country's about. We make other demands. We don't ask people to endure the unendurable, where they have outside pressures they have no control over. That isn't our way of life. No, we say, you do have power. I mean, you're also responsible. You must decide what your life is about, and you go and do that. You stay true to that. That is the way you bear the burdens of freedom. That is the demand that we make, and not a collective demand.
Which is really, and, you know, people think, I don't know, I hear from people all the time, we're so divided, and they assign that all to politics. But honestly, I think the topic that you bring up is also part of the Great Divide.
Yeah, yes, it is. I think that's right.
I think it's more fundamental to the Great Divide, maybe.
Yeah. Yeah, it's the groups that come from the non-West that are deeply pessimistic, and that pessimism isn't really coming from America. It's coming from their original countries. They're coming here to escape those countries, and it's understandable they should do that. But they express a fatalism, a powerlessness that we just can't accept. That is not our way of life. And
right.
we really have to say to them, that is not what this country's about. If you think you're powerless, you should go home.
Right.
You know, if you're going to be powerless, you can be powerless in your original country.
Well, what that's they why. Do, though, is they are dissatisfied, so their first line of attack is to bring their culture here.
Well, and if we're not unhappy like they are, then we're racist because we're...
Yeah, well, that's the way the advocates talk.
Back to the circle again.
The people who I criticize most are not the outgroups themselves, but they're advocates.
Right.
The advocates talk as if they were powerless, and they are not powerless. They personally are not powerless. They're usually quite successful. These are talented people who are getting ahead in their own way, but they're not helping their group. What they should, rather than to describe their group as powerless, they should be saying to them, here are ways we can get ahead. Here are ways we can, in fact, assert some power.
Yeah.
You and your children have to assert power over your lives.
Like we were told as kids, you can grow up and be who you want to be.
Well,
oh, my gosh, I knew an hour wasn't enough time. Dr. Lawrence Mead, we're out of time. But your book, Burdens of Freedom, it sounds awesome. We haven't had a chance to read it yet, but Cultural Difference in American Power.
Yeah.
I would encourage people to go to wethepeopleradio.us, look that up, and read it, and we will have you back.
Well, that would be a pleasure.
Thanks for that.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks
Bye-bye.
For being here.